This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Richard Alley's work as a climate scientist made him a co-recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize in 2007. Alley is a professor of geosciences at Penn State University. Television audiences may know him as the host of PBS's Earth, the Operator's Manual. On YouTube, Alley can be found explaining climate change to the tune of the Johnny Cash song Ring of Fire.
Subduction scraped off mud round a burning ring of fire. Takes water down, drives the volcanoes higher. Makes light.
Alley will speak at Albion College April 24th at the 25th Annual Elkin R. Isaac Student Research Symposium, and he joins us via Skype. Richard Alley, thank you for being with us.
It's my pleasure, Gordon.
I want to begin with an opinion piece that you wrote recently with your colleague at Penn State, Michael Mann, in which you say there simply are not two valid sides when it comes to the scientific evidence. Facts matter. What are the facts that matter when it comes to climate that the public may not be aware of or perhaps has some confusion about?
So it is true. Science is the best we can do. We get criticized from people who think that we're being alarmist. We get criticized by people who think we're not being alarming enough. You can shoot at scientists from a lot of different directions, but science is the center. It is not out on one edge. The basic idea, we burn fossil fuels, we get good from using that energy, but that releases CO2 to the air and that affects the climate, is old. There were estimates more than 100 years ago of how much warming we would get from our CO2. The physics really got worked out right after World War II, and the physics got worked out not to do climate change, but to do things such as heat-seeking missiles. The Air Force has one of their jobs is to make sure no one bombs cities, and you can use a heat-seeking missile, see the hot radiation from the enemy bomber, and you can fly up its tailpipe and make sure it doesn't drop a bomb on your city. But if you use the wrong sensor, CO2 blocks the view. And so the Air Force said, we have to understand how radiation interacts with gases in the air, and they worked it out. And it is absolutely clear today that there is more heat going up from the sun-warmed Earth than coming down from enemy bombers. And you take that same physics, and our CO2 has an unavoidable warming influence on the climate. This is validated every day. It is as close to fact as science gets.
How come we have such a hazy presentation of this then? Is that because of those of us in the media who try to seek balance when perhaps balance is not warranted? Is it because of education in the schools? Or is it a mix of that and maybe some other things?
I think you've got it right. It's a mix of that and some other things. It is very clear. People have looked at this, and the media plays a false balance game, and they like to set it up as two sides, the mainstream science arguing with the don't worry, be happy, we can't do anything to the climate side. The bizarre thing is that if you wanted a scientist to argue with someone, it might actually be more accurate to argue with someone who's really, really worried. And the reason is that science gives you the best estimate of what we face, but the uncertainties are a little more on the bad side than on the good side. We don't see any way that simply cranking up CO2 turns the world into Eden, but we see slight chances that CO2 could really break a lot of things that we care very deeply about. The best estimate is still the center of the science, but if the science is wrong, it's more likely that things will be worse than that things will be better.
There was an interview that you gave to Forbes back in 2012, and you told them that as a scientist, you try not to tell people what to do, that as a scientist, you try to present the facts, because once you say you start saying, well, we need to do this, people think you have some other agenda than that as a scientist. But if the problem is serious enough with climate change, should scientists at least be giving us a range of suggestions, maybe some various options that we might want to pursue to make it better?
I think you're right on that. I think we really do owe it to people to show what is possible to do, what the options are. And I've been engaged in this a little bit now through our TV shows, through one of these massively open online courses that I help teach, that we try to lay out some of the options. And there very clearly are many options. The don't worry, be happy, and we'll come back to this later option, which is somewhat what we've been doing recently. The let's get busy now and do something about it, but let's do it carefully. You know, there's a lot of things that could be done. And a lot of evidence, a lot of scholarship from economics as well as from the sciences, the harder sciences, showing that if we use the knowledge about climate change, if we use the science, we end up better off. We end up with a bigger economy. We end up with more jobs, with greater national security and other things.
Now, you've been on television. You know, if people go on YouTube, they might see you singing. Do you think that other scientists need to make efforts? Maybe they don't have that sort of talent, but do they need to make efforts to try to make this more accessible, reach an audience that otherwise says, oh, it's science, it makes my eyes glaze over?
I've rarely been accused of talent in my singing, so thank you. But I think we as a scientific community really do owe it to the public to make what we do accessible and engaging in a way that the public can use it. I don't think that every single scientist has to be out there on PBS, but I do think that enough of us have to be out there because a lot of what we do is paid for by the public. A lot of what we do is valuable to the public. And so I do think that we have a responsibility as a scientific community to do what we can to make this as useful as possible for people.
When you type the name Richard Alley into the Google search engine, you'll get some suggestions. One of them is Richard Alley Republican. Is Republican climate scientists a relatively small club?
I think you'd probably find that there are more climate scientists or registered independent or Democrat than a registered Republican, but I am not unique. I can tell you that with confidence. And so it is indeed true. What I always say, I am not going to tell anyone who I voted for in any given election, but my registration is a public document and I am registered as a Republican.
A few months back, we had former Republican Congressman Bob Inglis on this program, and he acknowledges, yes, climate change is real. What he discussed with us was some market-driven ideas for limiting climate change. Do you think that shows that there are there some different ideas out there that could work in terms of climate change, and it's just simply a matter of finding the right ones or some combination of different ideas that could address the problem?
Oh, absolutely. We, through history, have tried different ways to get our energy. And every time we've gotten onto one, we have had unintended consequences that we became very unhappy about. And as I'll talk about it, Albion, I come to you from Pennsylvania, Penn's Woods. We cut essentially every tree in the Commonwealth. Pennsylvania, they talked about the Pennsylvania desert because there were no trees left in Pennsylvania. We burned almost all the whales we could get a hold of out of the ocean to make whale oil light in the evenings. Every time we really have gotten onto an energy supply, we have seen unintended consequences that hurt us. And this is true of our use of fossil fuels. We get tremendous value out of fossil fuels, but eventually it has problems and eventually it runs out. And for the first time in human history, we can think about building an energy system that could look many different ways. And wind and sun, we might include some nuclear, we might not. We might include more waves, we might include more hot, dry rock, geothermal. But we can think about building an energy system that will power everyone on the planet almost forever. And we can see how it would be done. We see the technologies exist. We see that it is affordable. And a lot of people are now asking, how do we get to that one so that we don't have another energy crisis, so we don't run out of oil, coal, and gas the way we ran out of trees and whales? And so it is possible now. And as Representative Inglis has pointed out, there are many ways to get there. He in particular, as I recall, has been interested in carbon taxes.
Right.
Now, and this is worth walking through, we tax tobacco, and we do so to raise money for the government and to reduce smoking. And we tax alcohol, and we do that to raise money for the government and to reduce drinking. And we tax your paycheck, and we do that to raise money for the government. And any economist will say, and reduce working. By making your work less valuable to you, you are less likely to do more of it. It's very easy. If you were to go up to a random student at Albion and say, give me a hand, I'll give you 10 bucks, versus give me a hand, I'll give you $5 and I'll give the government $5, which is more likely to get them the help. And so I think what you would find Representative English would suggest is that if you were to put a tax on carbon to raise money for the government and to reduce climate change, and you were to use that to reduce the tax on your paycheck. So not to grow the government, not to, you know, make statues of me or anything like that, but to reduce the tax on wages. The scholarship says it will either have little impact on the economy or it will make the economy grow some, even if you ignore the benefits of avoiding climate change, because it's actually probably easier to substitute for carbon than it is to substitute for bright workers.
How far away are we from a true tipping point on climate change?
Cross fingers. Okay. This is, unfortunately, tipping points, we are confident that they do exist beyond some threshold. An ice sheet will melt and it will be very, very hard to keep it from melting. Beyond some threshold, the rainforest might burn and not grow back as a rainforest. We're confident that these things can occur. The problem is that seeing a tipping point coming is a very difficult task. So if you had a dimmer dial on your lights, it's very easy. You turn it a little and the light gets a little brighter or a little dimmer. If you have a light switch and you don't push hard enough, nothing happens. And as you push harder, at some point it flips. And knowing exactly how hard you have to push to flip it is a very difficult thing to do. And so we are moderately optimistic. In fact, the National Academy of Sciences just put out a report very recently that said the main physical tipping points, we're moderately optimistic. We're not exceedingly close to hitting them. But there's a slight chance that they're there, and there's a slight chance that we will hit one before we know it. And this is one of those things that sort of the uncertainties are mostly on the bad side. The possibility that we trigger something before we see it coming that is very costly. Even if that probability is low, it's not zero.
Richard Alley, thank you very much for your time.
Gordon, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Richard Alley is a professor of geosciences at Penn State University. He joined us via Skype. Alley will speak at Albion College next week at the 25th Annual Elkin R. Isaac Student Research Symposium. Links with more information and longer versions of the interviews on West Southwest can be found at wmuk.org. This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.